right. Welcome, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. I am Joe Danier, your host, and we get to talk about things that are happening with business, entrepreneurship, and sort of like if you got a side hustle or something that you're doing on the weekends or as a supplemental. I'm here to kind of coach you into either growing that part up or retooling that part up or even, you know, getting off the sidelines and starting to do something. I'm making the suggestion that all of you could probably do that, even if it's not a capacity where it takes over your full work week. It could be a little, you know, nice couple of dollars that you put together for some fun money to do it. So, and a lot of people wrap that in their passions, things that they like doing. So they go do their 9 to 5 and they grind it out and pay the bills that way and dedicate a couple hours a week to work on something that they don't mind doing quite as much as their regular. And so we set this stage up so that if any of you might have any questions, you know, I'll bring up sort of these hypotheticals to get us talking, maybe provoke you a little bit into new thought. Most of the time, super inspiring. And that's all I want to do is I want to engage, invoke, and inspire. And today's going to be a little bit different because I have sort of like a philosophy I want to dissect a little bit. And it's a little bit more controversial than our normal topics. It has to do, you know, with taxes. And it becomes a political thing. But on the Bottom Line Business Show, as the name suggests, this just gets down to, you know, brass tacks, right? We're just talking about the numbers, the binary result, the logical side of things, the things that we can count and add and measure, right? And so we're going to talk about taxes a little bit because it becomes this really weird thing where it's void of logic. And I cannot stand things that are void of logic. You get it too much. I mean, I am fueled by emotion and passion, but I'm guided by logic. That's the map. That's the, you know, where I'm headed, which way I'm pointed in, and the energy that I put behind it is how fast I get there. Around tax time, we get kind of silly because we start throwing these politically charged words around, and they mean more as a ideology than they do as a practical or a mechanical or a practice that we are faced with. If you don't pay taxes, right? Chances are most of us, the reason that we throw the weapon of taxation around is because most of the taxation stuff is done on our behalf. We don't feel the effects of it. And what I mean by this is the first part of my career, I did not draw a paycheck, right? I was drilling every penny into my operations that I possibly could. I only drew off enough so that I didn't die, right? So that I could just survive. So it may be $500 every couple of weeks. Maybe it was $100 some weeks. I left everything I could. I had a sign on my wall, which was take what you need, leave what you can. And with the philosophy, I was eyeballing things with how much I could leave in the system, because if I left it in the system, I could grow it bigger. And so that I didn't suffocate myself. I still was able to get through it, but I didn't, there was no, pretty stuff in that period of time. And so what ended up happening is that I would go all year taking the draws that I needed, and I don't feel like I took a whole lot. But then I would get to the end of the year where I had to pay the taxes, and it would all happen all at one time. So I had to write a big check. And I already didn't think I took a bunch of money drawn off of it. And then I had this huge check that I had to write at the end of the year, right? And so through many different accountants and planners, they guided me into doing things a little different. And one of which those things, instead of taking a draw where I didn't pay any taxes when I made the draw, put myself on a payroll with a reasonable amount of regular paycheck, and then so those taxes would be drafted off of the top. And remember, taxes, you as the employee are only responsible for half, right? 7.5%. The employer then matches part of your taxes, your employment tax, and now you're really paying 15%. So I was not only the employer, but I was also the employer. So I had to pay both sides of the taxes. So again, I had a little bit more respect because I wrote the checks. I'll tell you, you fast forward to now, I'm paying much more in taxes now than I did when I was just drawing and doing distributions that way. But because it comes out slower over a longer period of time, I almost feel like I'm paying less taxes. Because remember, proportionally, I was paying way more when I was doing it that way, and it was a big check all at one time. But if you let me make payments towards my tax liability, then it feels a little bit different. And so, I put myself on payroll to pay myself, you know, X amount of dollars, and then I never end up owing. I try to get it so that I don't owe anything, at the end of the year, and all is happy. I don't get the stress over that deal. So, but we get into these periods where people who already don't feel the negative effects of paying taxes get all of these ideological opinions about not necessarily what they should do, but what other people should do. And that's when it gets very political, and then we start taking people who are in different strata than we are, either above or below, and then we sort of like take our situation and we make them our situation and their situation universal without proper understanding of where they're at. And so this is where, you know, I get caught up sometimes in these discussions about taxation, because, again, we start doing these cliches like paying your fair share. Well, on the surface of paying your fair share, absolutely. And a subjective thing like what is your fair share, I had to discuss. And I usually come up with most of my best answers if you talk to someone who's oblivious to the political consequences. So if you talk to like a 13-year-old about what fair share means, you're going to get better insight than somebody who's already bought into the religion of a political persuasion and has an idea that supersedes that logic that goes into it. So fair, that means to me that all people do the same thing. It is fair across the board. You make a rule and everybody follows it. That's fair. Share, meaning share. Are we doing a percentage of overall consumption, a percentage of pay, whatever the perception. So if it is a function of fair percentage, okay, now we're having a discussion. But we have to have the second part of the discussion, which is when you have different things that don't fit into the, you know, I get a paycheck, because not everybody draws a paycheck. There are some people in our society that make a living off of dividends, right? Or ownership of companies, or, they have on pensions. All of us make money different. So a universally fair share would be a lot easier if we weren't all in different situations and having different contingencies. But we take ours and make it universal. And that's why this thing gets kind of political. But again, let's go back a little bit. And when it comes to these, companies, we'll say like the Amazons and the Facebooks, they make a considerable amount of money, right? And so when we talk about how they should be taxed, it's a very complicated deal when we say, are they paying their fair share, right? On today's standard, we'll pick Amazon's my favorite, because they probably you have to have a really long landscape view of where Amazon came from. And so if you take what Amazon did on day one, when Amazon lost a lot of money, and year two and year three, they lost a lot of money, and year four and year five, and they lost a lot of money. And so they kept rolling what they lost forward, and then they started making money. Well, if you then start to take what they made and don't take in consideration the investment of what they invested, you might not have a physical break even for a number of years into making that money. And that's why the system gets complicated, because we're looking at it through the eyes of we're not doing that, and we're judging the fact that, oh, you made $5 billion. Where's your 15%? Well, my tax return's 500 pages long, and I'm rolling in some losses from 10 years ago. Well, that doesn't even make sense to me, because we're not allowed to roll losses in from 10 years ago, because there's no such thing. We're taxed on income. So anyway, the way that we feel about businesses translates down, and you have sort of like an ill view of some of these companies because of how this ideology has framed them in the worst possible light. And they don't do any favors for themselves either. But it's still I don't like that. Sure, go after Facebooks and Amazons, right? Go for it. I mean, they can defend themselves. They don't need me to stand up for them. They don't need anything. They can do their own thing. But it's the crossfire people. When you start gunning at people that are not Amazon and Facebook, and they get caught in the same net when you're trying to penalize somebody who's successful with the taxation, because I don't think taxation should be a punishment or a weapon, right? Taxation is supposed to pay for things that we need. And if you're going to say, are we not taxed enough, or are we taxed too much? And then it becomes ideological. We can't have a logical discussion. What is too much? Who's not paying? And that's why I say this thing is so sophisticated and complicated. I don't necessarily think through attrition or any other way that we end up making it better, right? You're going to go – basically what you're going to do is you're going to oscillate depending on who's in the White House. You're going to scrape some taxes back, and then whoever's next in the White House, you're going to push some back, and that's where we're going to live between the oscillations between the two governing. Maybe that's where our best deal. Maybe nobody should win. But in my eyes, if you can't fix what is – and I think what when you sort of divide down how it's broken, I think that – We have two types of spending that are stuck in this system. We have the stuff that has to be done, and then you have the stuff that we want to be done. And so that we're paying for both of those things with the same taxes. And so I think if we did two things, like we have a structural tax, like the things that make us operate, the bare minimum, like that gets the light. Because when I was building a business, I wasn't spending anything on niceties, right? I was just making the lights turn on and paying the bare minimum until I got my crap together. And so I call that the structural tax of what I had to pay to get there. And then you have, once you're there and you got the structure, then you have extra, then you can decide that you want to put it in niceties to make things happen. And the problem is that we leverage the structural things against to get the niceties, because when it comes to politics, that's just how the game is played. That's the dance. It turns me off, that kind of stuff, because we're not even playing a game of intelligence. We're playing a game of manipulation. And I'm just not good at that dance. I'm too honest of a guy to do that dance. You know, just let's deal with things how they are, right? Let's, you know, if you want to do spending on things that you know, for instance, like if it doesn't have to be done, let's not make it permanent, right? Let's keep discussing it and see if we keep wanting to do it. Those kind of things. So if it's a good idea and you happen to slide it through, let's make sure that in 5 years from now that you can slide it through again because it's still a good idea. And I think I would feel better about it even if I'm not benefiting from it. Ask a 13-year-old whether or not they should have to pay for something that they get no benefits from, and ask them if that's fair, right? That's also not fair. But honestly, because there are so many more people that would agree that they're not going to feel bad for someone who makes $1 billion, whether or not they pay more taxes than they're getting, the value from, they're not going to feel bad for that. So there's not one company or not one billionaire that's going to try to make that case. But if we're talking about fairness, well, then objective people have to turn around and say, well, that's not fair either, guys. I mean, if we're doing fairness, let's do the principle of fairness, which is, you know, might go into areas that benefit your argument, and it's going to go into areas that maybe go run counter to your argument. But that, again, that's – we get kind of crazy and we get kind of personal when it comes to this. But the idea is when you're structuring your company and your enterprises, taxes are a consideration. Early on, I had one of our accountants – she was really anti-tax. So if we made more money, there was sort of like this negative light that making more money, because then you had to pay more taxes. And so it conditioned me early on that making money was bad because you got the repercussions of a tax system that was just going to take more of your money. And honestly, that, remember, it was really just me in the very beginning. So I did the work, and then when they took taxes from me, they were just taking the benefits of my work. It wasn't like the work of other people was going into that pot. It was like mine. I'm like, okay, well, why do they deserve 25% of the work that I did? So I carried a little bit of resentment that they were just taking from me without, you know, remember, again, starting a business, you will probably have more run-ins on the negative side of dealing with the government than the positive. So they take all my money, and they get in my way and make things more expensive and make me have to conform to these standards. I mean, who's working for who here? Like, I'm paying you money. I should feel some value in that you're trying to make something easier for me. So I had a lot of early resentment for the whole tax system and the whole government thing, just because of how hard it made it on someone like me to get things started. And I'm not complaining. I mean, I was stupid and I went my own way and I did the school of hard knocks. And when you do that, that's how you learn, is those frictions is what teaches you what you should and shouldn't do. And I'm thankful that those pressures were there, because I think I learned really fast because I allowed myself to be uncomfortable when I did stupid things, and I learned from them super quick and I started doing smart things. And I want to always make sure that the business environment rewards good behavior and penalizes bad behavior. So when anybody says, hey, you became a billionaire because you were a criminal, all right, well, that's a pretty substantial charge. And if you're a criminal, I don't necessarily think you should become a billionaire or stay a billionaire. I think you should go to jail or forfeit the gains by criminal behavior, right? I mean, that's what would be fair. But then it really really degrades down that, well, criminal is then, we're not really, they're not really crimes. They're like I had two people on Facebook yesterday say that, well, companies make money on the backs of other people, all right? But they created that's a criminal offense, that when somebody does work and you bill for it and you collect it, that somehow that's a crime. Well, I would say that, you know, from an objector standpoint, if somebody took something from you, you did the work and you didn't get the paycheck, you'd probably have the same, disagreement as well. But it wasn't a crime. So if we need better laws, if we need to set the rules so nobody gets to charge for somebody else's work. Okay, well, that's a discussion that we could totally have. But again, when you get in those ideological things, we don't make progress because it's too much emotion and not enough logic. So 330-729-9977 if you want to text me, 333-1570. You're listening to the Bottom Line Business Show here on 570 WKBM. I'll be back. All right. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. We're talking a little bit about taxes today. So if you have any insight on in the business community, in the business world, what is fair share? What do we mean by tackling the inequities in taxation between people and corporations and entities and investors and all of those stuff? Give me your opinion. Tell me what you think. 330-729-9977. Let's go to Gary. Gary, you're on the Bottom Line Business Show. How can I help you?
Just the first one. Sorry, I'm ordering takeout right now. So basically, I wanted to call in because our CPA, we don't have a lot of trust in their situation because I run my own business, but I'm a one man show, and I feel like based on how much I make, certainly I doubled what I made last year or compared to last year. There's probably some other better way to structure things because we paid like $37,000 in taxes this year on the federal level alone. And I just filed as just like an LLC. I was told by somebody, once you make above a certain amount, you should try look into doing S Corp. Is that anything you know about?
Well, I have every year I sit down with my accountant and they look at the books and see when I'm ready for that kind of stuff. And I don't necessarily think it's one rule that puts you in there. They're trying to prevent you from appearing on the radar of bad things happening. So I think as you near the gray areas that put you on that radar is when they start making suggestions that maybe do different things. For the first couple of years, having a bunch of losses and carrying over those things year to year, they're not as concerned. But when you get 10 years deep into it, now the profile looks a little bit different, and then you have to start adjusting how you do business to conform mm-hmm. to the rules.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I talk to some people and they're like, geez, you paid that much in taxes, based on what I made. And then this is like a small mom and pop CPA. Like they don't really deal with businesses. So yeah, I'll probably just look into, I assume you even offer recommendations for like CPA for actual businesses or.
Well, question. So you're just taking a draw and then filing quarterlies. Is that how you're doing it now?
Yeah, we file quarterlies. And that's what you've been doing probably for like the past 4 or 5 years, because they give you a small penalty if you don't do that and you do the one lump sum at the end. And like you said, it does, it makes it not as bad when you're just paying one massive sum. Being the fact that I made double what I did last year, it bumped us up into a higher tax bracket. So when it came time to do our taxes this year, like, yeah, you owe $7,000 more than what you already owed. And then we just got a letter from the IRS yesterday saying that we owe $6,000 more on top of that. So we're like, what is going on?
Yeah. Okay, so here's what we did. We were in your same boat. We had a small CPA firm. It was cheap. I think it was $300 once a year to kind of get everything going. And then we went – we had Hilberth and King, who is a really good ally here in the Valley. And they mm-hmm. were more expensive to file. I think it doubled and sometimes tripled what we were paying before. But for mm-hmm. what they saved us and what we have to send off to the government, it is one of the best financial decisions that we made. So I would pick, get some recommendations other than mine, but we did HBK and it is paid in huge dividends from what we're saving.
Cool. All right. Awesome. Yeah. I don't know much about the tax stuff, but I do know there's some type of thing if you're an S Corp, then you basically, you denote yourself as an employee based on the trade or your skill, and you pay yourself, and somehow it works out to be less taxation.
Yep, absolutely. And if you hang tight, you know what, I'm going to let you go now, and then if you listen up, I'll on the other side of this break, I'll do a little bit more explanation from our side. I just wanted to say real quick that, you know, when you're in business, I know you end up wearing a lot of hats, marketing hats, accounting hats, and don't be afraid to shop specialties that are outside. I know we're penny pinchers by default. I know we want to save money and have efficiencies. We're problem solvers, right? But one of the big mistakes that I made was waiting too long before I offloaded that. And in the mind of an entrepreneur, we're usually at the knife's edge when it comes to to cash flows and where we do our investments and reinvesting in the companies. So justifying the extra expense of offloading something that we might be able to do. I've spent more money cleaning up the messes from me trying to do crap myself that I was not cut out for than if I'd have just turned around and put it in someone's lap that was able to do it. That is my number one recommendation. Solid accountant that knows your business model and can make can shake you a little bit and make you do things against your will. And number two, an attorney, someone who can guide you through the legalities and keep you in conforming to things that would get you into trouble. For the first 5 years, I swear to you, I had a $10,000 penalty every year from just doing stupid stuff. And once I started offloading that to people who know what they're doing, the $10,000 penalty a year disappeared, and the expenses that went up from adding into the specialties barely budged. I went from $300 to maybe $900 a year, right? But it saved me $9,000 a year overall. So it's my number one recommendation. Put the important things in the laps of people who know what they're doing. Don't let your entrepreneur brain think that you can pull it off, because that is not where you need to be spending your time and energy. All right, I'll come back and I'll share a little bit about how we structured things too. 330-729-9977 or text me 333-1570. You're listening to the Bottom Line Business Show here on 570 WKBN. I'll be back. All right. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. We're spending some time talking about taxes. It's that time of year again. And as we talked to the last caller, very similar trail. You get an LLC. You are structured as a sole proprietorship. It is you. It's you're a sole practitioner. And you start taking draws off of the books to pay yourself. And at the end of the year, you write a check or you go quarterly. I remember when I first started, I would just do it once a year, big check at the end of the year. And then, the accountant was nudging me to keep doing quarterlies, where you look at your books every 3 months, you file to see if you made any money, and then you would pay those quarterly estimates rather than waiting to the end of the year, because the government really doesn't want to wait till the end of the year to get all of their money. But if you lost money or you broke even, then they want what you think you should pay, and it's a faster way of sending them your taxes. And then 1 year, we were coached into converting our LLC into an S corp, and then there's some rules. I mean, so you really do want to talk to a person that specializes and does this, how you should handle it, switching yourself over to a paid employee. 1099s and contract employees are. Have a very explicit list of things that they would like to do. During my era in the computer industry, I mean, there was so much abuse on the 1099 field that employees were cheaper if you made them pay their own taxes, right? And they were just a contractor. So there was a big push for a lot of people to sort of misuse the 1099, and they cracked down on it pretty good and made a whole list of things that you're not in 1099 if this is true. And if you hit too many things off of there, you can get into some trouble. So a good accountant is going to kind of keep you, safe from doing those things that are going to put you in some bad light. We switched over so that we don't take many draws. If we have a good quarter, we're doing a capital improvement, or we're doing something that needs to draw off of it that's outside of a paycheck, we do it. But there's far less of that has to be taxed at that higher rate, because that's what ends up happening, is that stuff is still you know, you still have to do on employment taxes on that number, and so it ends up being a larger bulk of a number. So again, I would check with a licensed or a very competent accountant. You're going to need one of those. And just like as a homeowner, you have your go-to heating and cooling and your electrician and your plumbing, your Rolodex is filled with people. If something should happen, you are prepared. Well, in the business world, it's the same thing. You have to have go-to people, because in a pinch, if you end up just going through the yellow pages, if that's even a thing now, that you will probably end up with someone who might be able to do it, but might not be very competent at it. And you're going to get yourself stuck. So right now, when things are fine, you want to ask other business professionals who they use, how they're happy, and try to profile yourself in comparison to other people. And the last caller was almost identical to where we were a while ago. And so that's why I can recommend that they're probably going to be switched in the same way, because they're getting to the realized profits part, and they don't want to get hammered with the taxation that shouldn't be because of where they sit. Because you got to think of it, taxes is a game when it comes to companies. And so it is skewed very heavy to chase wherever the money is. And regardless if that money is realized money or not, if you don't do it proper, you might have something get taxed that really, you know, given enough time, won't be taxed. But if you do it the wrong way, it ends up getting taxed, and it's not like you get to untax it at some point. So it's a game that's played. So you have to know how the rules are set and just follow the guidance of people who watch this stuff for a living. And then, you know, kind of take their advice. Even, like I said, I was the most stubborn person when it meant to get in the way of what I thought was an expensive venture. And I ended up sabotaging a lot of the really good advice I was getting because I was too stubborn to take the advice. And where I got there eventually, I probably paid 4 years where I didn't have to, because I had to overcome me, not necessarily any external force. It was all Joe. I did get the question this week, too, about the EIDL loans. If you took one of these SBA EIDL loans, it was probably one of the first coronavirus relief funding sources that there were. They ended up releasing it as a partial grant coupled with a government SBA loan. And then so lots of people applied for this loan to get the grant portion of it. Some of us kept the loan portion, and some of us just didn't take the loan but took the grant. Well, a lot of you that are holding an EIDL loan, they gave you a nice time horizon to defer payments. And so it was first, I believe, 12 months, so that you had right till about now. And I heard last week that they kicked that back to 24 months without you having to make a payment back towards the loan. But I want to recommend to you that you make payments on this loan, even though you don't have to, because the interest is still calculated from the day that the loan was authored. So if your loan was $10,000 and you're paying 4% on $10,000, you know, you're going to do, you know, some $40 a month in interest, and that has started as soon as the loan was issued. So you want to take a look at what's you know, take a look at your statement that they've mailed you, and, you know, don't get comfortable just waiting the full 2 years, because that, you know, $50,000 loan is not going to be $50,000 when you start making payments in 24 months. It's going to be, you know, plus whatever the interest put on top of that. So we took the loan and we almost immediately started paying. I think we let a couple months go by before we started paying. And so I think we've kept about even on the interest, and so it's probably going to be right where it is. They asked me whether or not the EIDL loan might, you know, there's a potential for it to be part of what's forgiven, and I do not believe that that's going to be part of it. There was so much liquidity, so much money that was pushed out in, you know, PPP1, PPP2. I just don't think the need for having that forgiven as a, you know, I thought maybe the EIDL loan would get forgiven because, you know, maybe a stopgap, they couldn't get one of the things through Congress. So since there was already people holding paper, forgiving the paper that they already hold, I thought maybe there was a possibility, but I do not believe that's going to be the case anymore. So that's just a loan. And I tried to impress on most of you that this is a loan that has to be paid back. It is not free money that you're, you know, that you need to frivolously spend. So that if you paid it out in payrolls to employees for a period of time and you weren't collecting any revenue because of it, then that money is going to have to be paid back in the future, but you didn't get any gains from the investment. So that's going to be a really tough one. Now, if you took some of that money and you expanded operations, or you created a pivot and a wing of your company where you can make revenue, when things return and the old portion comes back coupled with the new portion, then you're going to realize the expansion, and then you'll be able to collect and have actual growth because of that EIDL loan. But it was a dangerous one because it felt like it was so free to be given, and it was just a loan, as if it was hard to get and you had to sit in an office and, you know, give them a business plan and really convince them. It's still that same kind of loan on the payback side. So I hope all of you are nice and careful with that. And do I expect any more PPP loans? No, I think, I think we've got afterburners on right now. We're going to get back to normalcy. Businesses are going to get back to it. And I don't think there's going to be a need for anything else. There's still going to be, I think the marketplace is still flush with cash. I think there's still a lot of people that have money to spend, especially with the child tax credits that are going to be going out the way that they are. So if you're in business and you want to capture that influx of consumer money into the market, you should start positioning yourself now and take that all the way through summer. I think outdoor stuff is going to be huge this deal, camping, hunting, fishing, anywhere to get out. I think we're totally conditioned now to find happiness in doing things that aren't with concentrations of people. But at the same time, I think we've been pent up, and we're going to be really eager to do things like outdoor events and stuff like that. So I'm pretty sure that you should, if you're in those spaces, that you should be drilling into being ready for that extra consumer spending that's going to happen. Downside is we got fuel prices that are stupid high, and it's going to suck a lot of that value out of the marketplace, which sucks. So I hope that gets under control. We see a lot of these other, the lumber prices and some electronics and chip prices. A lot of this stuff is doing just that, where we got this extra cash. But the balancing pressure is that we've inflated. In a perfect storm, you'd get this cash that comes in without increasing the prices. And it just has never happened as far as I can ever see. So you never really get to enjoy that extra cash, because then once you get extra cash, then everything costs more that you have to buy, like fuel and lumber and, microchips. And it's almost like if you made a bunch of money in Youngstown, Ohio, and then you said, hey, I got a bunch of money, and you went and bought a house in Los Angeles, right? You would look around saying, this was not even a lateral move. This feels like a backwards move. This was. So anyway, it's a little depressing that we know we got this extra cash that's coming in, and we can make preparation. And if you do that, you'll probably at least be at level at zero. Might not be a huge profit incentive to do this, but it's going to be a requirement. I'm hopeful, though, that they get a control on these prices that have gone up, and then there will be a realized profit motive. So do it anyway. How about that? Just do it anyway. Get prepared for people getting back to normal. Do your thing. Get back in the groove of things. I got so sick of waiting. I started announcing like in early spring or January, February that I was just done. I'm just do it safely. Get back to the basics and get all the machinery running again. Okay. One of the segments that I've been doing is scam baiting. So if you're following me over on social media, I'm putting some effort into calling around at some of those scams. And I'll talk a little about this on the computer show next, but it's opening my eyes in a lot of ways with how many services that are in the marketplace that are not legit. Like they are not, and it's not that they're posing. I mean, they're not legit. They look like legit, but they're not legit. And I do a lot of my research, and when I'm looking for components, I buy from companies I've never dealt with before. And so a lot of my vendors, I wonder how many of those that I, pushed money through a company that was just a total scam. And so it's important, I think, for the integrity of when we push out what business is, that when we come across business that isn't what we're talking about, that's a flavor of just exploitative or criminal, that we don't let them to be put to the same, because that's not our pursuit. That is not adding value. That's deception. That's taking advantage of people. That's lying to people. And then these gray areas where legitimate companies are getting into into practices that totally suck for the consumer. I'll give you an example. So we did it. We have a service that we use, and it's a legitimate service. It's information. We buy it. We use it. Whatever. And we have to pay for it by a year. It's $100 a month, and they require that you buy a year's worth of it. And I don't like buying it at a year's worth. That seems pretty like hardcore. Why take my money for a year? Give me a monthly fee. I'll be there for a year. But let me, as a consumer, if I don't need the product anymore, I'm not stuck for a year. So, okay, I begrudgingly said, let's do a year, and I paid for a year. Well, the year expires June 20th, right? And so I get an email like the end of May 27th, and it says, hey, your subscription or your services are expiring. Please go to the website and pay for this. And I was like, oh, I've totally forgot I even had this. So let me go in there and say, okay, yes, please just cancel this before it renews. And they said, I'm sorry, but you have to cancel 30 days before the renewal date, and you have to show me an email that says you tried to cancel 30 days. And I said, well, I just received the notification that it was going to be expiring 26 days before it expired. So the notification was already inside the less than 30 days to actually cancel. So that one, now I'll probably use the service, right? Because it's information, and that's what we do. But it was totally the most scammiest, slimiest way to get me to resubscribe. I almost want to fight it and you know, not pay it. I'd rather pay legal fees than actually pay something where I felt like I was forced into it. But it got me thinking, like, business practices, when they get aggressive, when they lose sort of their moral compass, this is the kind of crap that consumers get pulled into. And I feel like I'm a consumer that sees a lot more individual transactions, and that's not normal. That's not something that that you know, normal consumer would ever in a million years put up with. And the reason I'm bringing this up during this, that we're talking about taxes in the same way, where we'll continue to pay more taxes as long as we hide the method. But if we spring it all at you at one day, we feel – when I had to write those big checks, it wasn't because they were big checks. I was looking at the amount that they were taking from me in proportion that I have to wait for mine, like all – you know, I have to wait for mine a little over time, and I have to be smart with it. You just get to take whatever you want. I feel it's way too much, and that's why I feel like – you know, the scams, the practices that these services are using make you feel really bad. And from a business standpoint, I mean, I can't look at any of my operations and said, could I ever do that? Number one, I couldn't do that just from a moral standpoint. I couldn't do that to people. But if I held somebody hostage to my services, I mean, I wouldn't be at my best when somebody had to stick with me. I don't think that they would have much faith in me or have much respect for me if I held them hostage to use my services against their will. I mean, again, I'm maybe a little bit more idealistic when it comes to this stuff, but I don't ever want to deal with that company ever again. And again, it's the thinking, the game that I'm playing and comparing it between this and taxes. It just makes you feel really slimy when you frame it this. They're taking money from you. All right. Okay. If you're going to take money from me, at least make me feel good about it. Let's do it. Give me some choices of saying yes or no. Make sure that I get good value for what you're exchanging with me. You're adding more value in, or at least I can count the value. I can measure the value that I'm getting in return for what you're taking from me. All those things, you know, very sensitive. So my scam baiting, right? My scam baiting might have me calling the IRS before too much longer. I'm not going to say that too loud because I don't want to be put on the radar. I mean, my accountant keeps me off the radar, and I just say things on the radar that put me on the radar. So I'm sorry. I didn't really mean it. Yeah, I'll probably do it, but no, I won't. 330-729-9977. Text me, 333-1570. You're listening to the Bottom Line Business Show here on 570 WKBN. I'll be back. All right. Welcome back, everybody. This is the Bottom Line Business Show. I am Joe Danier, your host, talking about things in business and taxes and a little bit of financial planning. This question is, how do you manage working capital for a small business? This is a good question because this is this sort of like takes a little bit of storytelling and setup about working capital. So really, the way that we do it operationally is we sort of have spreadsheets that manage different, like picture almost envelopes of where when revenue comes in the door, it gets split out and it get, gets put in its envelope for separate things. So you have the portion that goes towards funding labor costs and goes towards marketing. Some goes towards retained earnings or research and development. Some of it goes out in taxes. So every dollar that comes through sort of gets split off and gets put into its envelope so that it gets, we have sort of it budgeted. And so working capital, how we manage it is that it's sort of in a very abstract way where a lot of our envelopes grow much beyond what we actually consume. So we have the ability to use some of our envelopes to be able to, set up as an emergency fund. But the business principles are sort of like almost what you would use in your private life, what you would want to do. Okay. So if you get a downturn in the market, how long do you want to be able to operate your business and survive without having to cut your sales force and your employees and your marketing, right? You want to be able to adjust and run operations the way that it is right now and have funding to do it for a period, even if environmental things change. So we play really defensive on, we like to withhold a lot of our reserves just in case something should happen. And if something doesn't happen, then we're free to make investments into new projects and stuff like that. So the smarter we are, the more money we have to do even more smart things. Versus the other side of that is I don't like the reactive side, where, something happens and we got to dig up to find out how we're going to cover for it. I like there to already be a net and have nets that we've never had to use is my best way to not worry about anything that's happening. Now, one consideration is that when you get into a part of the market that, if we're in inflation times right now and you have a bunch of cash, a bunch of cash that is at your disposal, you're losing a little bit of inflation value by having it sit in cash. So where could you move it or put it or do what you could do with it? Again, this is one of those deals that you want to take some kind of financial advisor. You need liquidity. You need to be able to put that in your payroll account and pay payroll with it. But if it's sitting in cash being devalued by, inflation, I knew that I was sitting on way too much cash in some of my reserves. And so I started making moves of putting it in places that would hold some value, not investments. Like I wanted to just hold value. I didn't necessarily want to make money on it. That's not what it's there for. But I just wanted to hold value better than, the fuel cost. Like you got to look at it. Like we literally put gas in our cars to do our job, right? So when that expense goes up, you're devaluing the revenue on labor because the cost of fetching that labor or that revenue goes up with the expenses that go along with it. And so, but there's money held in the fuel. Now, what happens if you can get the fuel money that's in reserves to appreciate in value or at least stay to value as costs go up? Well, then you don't have to change pricing. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to contribute to even more inflation by having to react to it. And so that's where a financial planner is going to say, okay, well, you have like 6 months of reserves. Give me about 6 months of putting it somewhere to give you maybe 10%. And then you can weather a 10% adjustment up in fuel costs 6 months from now. And you get to play a game with fetching some future something in that mix. But you need somebody who's better at that kind of stuff than I am, because I feel like I sat in cash way too long and I'm at things that aren't, I was way too slow to react. So I hope that answered your question, but you have to be deliberate about it. You have to figure out when revenue comes in, where it's going to go. It's not just a matter of just paying the expenses, and it's not just a matter of setting up reserves to fund shortfalls. It's also, while it's sitting there, what could you be doing with it? And I've been around all kind of corporations. Some of them, create entities that funnel their cash into, investment properties and investments, and they sit there for a period of time before they're pulled back out and used for something. And sometimes I don't know. There's a bunch of stuff that you could do with it, but financial planner is going to have a little bit better advice than Joe is, because I don't feel like I'm doing it all that well. I hope to in the future, but I still feel like I'm good to go. In comparison to most people, I'm probably ahead of the game, but there's probably more that could be done if I had some more brain power behind me, giving me, or taking the reins and doing what they do for a living, so I could get back to doing what I do for a living, which is start companies, grow them, scale them, expand them, and stuff like that. So thank you for that question. It is important. I went on Facebook a couple months ago. I said, hey, if you're in cash right now, you probably don't want to be. And that was leading up to all of this huge amounts of money that was put out to consumers. You just knew they had no chance but to create some kind of inflation somewhere, and that's what I was a little bit, you know, a little bit afraid of. But so far, so good. In our deal, we've been sort of like a buffer, because when everything got expensive, we just did, okay, so before we have a total amount that things cost us, and then we do our markup. We were able to do some smart buying and you know, buy enough ahead of that curve that I looked at our costs and it's almost identical to where it was 1 year ago. So we didn't have to adjust our prices up to compensate, because we took in inventory when it was lower and we were able to make it through. So thanks everybody for listening. I appreciate it. We're going to come up next with the Youngstown Computer Show. So stay tuned. We're going to talk about tech and physics and all that kind of stuff. Thanks for listening. This has been the Bottom Line Business Show on 570 WKBN.